This is Kathy Damaris, bound to reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from the September 2025 issue of Arizona Highways. Joyce Rockwood is the author of The Green Roof of the Kaibab. Editor's note, the celebration of our 100th anniversary continues with another wonderful piece from another wonderful writer. This month is Joyce Rockwood. At the time of her debut in 1939, Ms. Rockwood was the wife of photographer Joseph Munch. That's how she met our editor, but her place in our magazine's history is based exclusively on her incredible talent as a writer. She could write about any subject, but Mother Nature was her sweet spot. There's no experience quite like being alone in the open glades of Ponderosa, she writes in this feature from June 1954. Deep piled rugs of needle and cone woven by the trees lend a buoyancy to the feet, and aromatic fragrance of air invites deep breaths and perhaps a sudden sprint to see if one can run. Like Robert Frost, her words could take a writer anywhere in the great outdoors. In April, Ms. Rockwood joined 14 others in the inaugural class of the Arizona Highways Hall of Fame. Roll the Paiute word kaibab over your tongue a few times to get the unique flavor of the Indian name for a very special place. Pronounced kaibab, it's short for the mountain lying down, a lofty, imposing headland jutting into the northern Arizona sky that wears as a living mantle one of the most splendid floors known to man. Just as you'll find the title in no other region, so the rare beauties of this mountain segment of the soaring Colorado Plateau are repeated nowhere else. There is no rocky, storm-swept summit, and all of its elevations from 5,000 to 9,000 feet above sea level are under the green roof that stretches a generous 55 miles from north to south. You can drive your car the whole length along sunny corridors through airy cathedrals, bathed in the crystal clear, heady air of the highlands. No king has ever been able to boast a park so expansive as these deer-hilled forest aisles, mellowed by hundreds of years of Arizona sunshine. The world's largest stand of virgin ponderosa pine, shoulder to shoulder with thick woodlands of Douglas fir, spruce, and aspen, wears garlands of flowers in spring, and summer weaves her gentle magic over them. Aspens flaunt their golden autumn against the blur of conifers, and in winter the whole forest is wrapped in white, shutting out all but the hardiest visitors while the mountain sleeps. Though far inland, the pounding of waves can be heard here as winds rush through the upper balconies of treetops in a sea of surging sound, while on the soft carpet underneath, many animals step cautiously. Big kaibab deer of spreading antlers and gleaming coat, rare white-tailed kaibab squirrels, which live nowhere else, and mountain lion and bobcat are at home, and congregations of birds singing paeans of praise are part of its lilting charm. For generations, the Paiutes had claimed the region as their fall hunting grounds, and it was they who guided the first white men over the confusing terrain, leading to perennial springs and pointing out the easiest route back down into the desert that girdles the cool heights. From the prismatic plains to the north, U.S. Route 89A makes a gliding start, easing up over Lefevre Ridge to bring the visitor deep within scented groves, forest arms around him, before he is aware of having climbed a mountain. Then it turns wolfly away to the east and switchbacks down again into a view of sunburnt House Rock Valley. Few see the western escarpment, a wilderness of cliff and gorge, but on the south, the kaibab is sliced off, sheer in the world-famous climax of the north rim of the Grand Canyon. Because of this spectacular denouement, the forests are less well-known than they deserve to be. Most people are in such a hurry to get there, they think of the kaibab merely as a convenient approach and leaving, view the tranquil stretching green as little more than a soothing relief from the tumult of color and form in the canyon. Those bared cliffs of the Colorado River's immense chasm blare out one of the secrets of the kaibab, showing dramatically the 800-foot layer of kaibab limestone that caps the entire mountain. Laid down in ancient times under the waters of a vast inland sea, the stone is built of bodies of marine creatures and acts as a sponge, so thirsty for melted snow and summer rains that no running streams are to be found on the Great Plateau. If the unusual formation were not enough to set the headland apart from others, there are further countless sinks where the limestone has dissolved out in seeping water and dropped to form basins for delightful miniature lakes ensconced in emerald green meadows tucked away among the trees. Indian legend, as usual, has a colorful explanation for the inconsistencies of this beloved mountain. Paiute children early learned that the Great Spirit built the mountain lying down, planted it with vegetation, and stocked it with deer for the very special benefit of the tribe. It was to be their hunting ground in the fall, when they would shoot the deer already fat for winter, play their games of chance, trade among themselves, and then go back to their winter homes. But because the Indians failed to appreciate all he had done for them, the Great Spirit became angered. He punished them with storms and cold and earthquakes. The high places were made low and the low places were made high, and many were killed when rocks fell on them. Still not appeased, their God cut off part of the mountain to keep his people from crossing over to the south and let water run through the terrible gap, Pa-o-wee, Canyon of Water, which we know as the Grand Canyon. If legends are still told among the Paiutes, now scattered on small reservations, perhaps they blame their God for having finally taken the kaibab from them, giving it to the white man for his hunting ground. In less than 2 hours, you can rush through the whole mountain on a fine paved road, and many do just that, missing the secretive world of the forest primeval with its peace and tranquility. Along little side roads, beyond sound of cars, the kaibab opens its heart, unlocking chapels lit by the candelabra of pines. There is no experience quite like being alone in the open glades of Ponderosa. Deep piled rugs of needle and cone, woven by the trees, lend a buoyancy to the feet, and an aromatic fragrance of air invites deep breaths and perhaps a sudden sprint to see if one can run. On every hand, brown trunks stand tall and straight as a mass of ships, soaring up to be lost in the dark ceiling through which the dark sky can be more felt than seen. The feeding of spaciousness and order comes from the very nature of the pines themselves. Tolerating only their own kind and demanding room to lift great branches, the ponderosas use acid in its fallen needles to kill out all but its young, which stand gawky and limber in small bands. They resemble their parents chiefly in lovely rosettes of long needles, catching the light in a sunburst and scattering it like a glowing sparkler. Crowded nurseries gradually thin out, leaving just the strongest trees with clean boles, self-pruned as shaded lower branches drop off. Free of underbrush and singularly inviting, these open parks are distinctive features of the kaibab. Dominant tree of the mountain, the ponderosa, is a bold explorer, often seeking out the most exposed and prominent posts to spend its 5 centuries, defiant of crippling storms and scarring lightning bolts. But in the rolling highlands, among its fellows, there is a tree of peace and dignity, reaching to more than 100 feet and noble in a sheathing of golden plates, symbol of maturity. At higher elevations, the forests become more dense, favoring Engelmann and blue spruce and fir. Of a more conventional turn of mind, these conifers taper gracefully in Christmas tree contours. They take particular delight in decorating low meadows, offering vistas quite in contrast to the pine woods, but altogether lovely. Again, the word park comes irresistibly to mind, as green swards sweep wide and spacious, or bend coquettishly out of sight to lure visitors farther among their company. A saint may be the center of interest, reflecting a rolling pageant of clouds in its tinted bowl, or again, where grass has swallowed up the water, green waves lap against forest walls that rise in tiers from tiny trees, edging timidly into the open, to pyramids of taller forms painted a dozen shades of green. Cattle grazing is permitted only in the national forest, but the meadows know nothing of such arbitrary boundaries, playing host to the white faces that graze contentedly, or to the shire deer who take over these handsome dining rooms in early morning and at dusk to add a last touch of perfection. Everywhere in the mountain, aspens bring an accent of white trunk and trembling draperies. Deep in the forest, scattered groups stand like fluttering white-limbed ghosts, but they surround the meadows with an air of festivity, whether in a mist green of spring foliage, full-toned summer tints, or the rollicking gold of early autumn. Even bare of leaves, their gray smoke, amassed in hollows or on hillsides, is exquisite. The self-conscious tree seems always in a hurry to be gone, quivering with excitement, as ephemeral as a butterfly. Perhaps conscious that its visit is limited and it comes into the more confident forest to cover scars left by fire, the aspen never settles down and after a brief 50 years yields the spot to pine, fir, or spruce, and you must look elsewhere for the elfin spirit in green and white. In places, they achieve a more solid footing, taking over areas and growing into mature groves impressive in individual tree and extent. Dark pigmentine on the trunks lends added character to the thickening boles, and the reflected light singing among them is distilled sunshine, filtered and purified. Along the swaying road that leads to Point Imperial and Cape Royal within the park, they nestle in deep swales, filling hollows with shimmering green. Around their glistening trunks, spring sends up a delicate covering of bracken, knee-deep and responsive to any capricious little breeze. Aspen seems to consider, as well, that no meadow or sink is properly decorated without at least a few of their number, and take care to group trunks in artistic white lines to offset the trim cones of conifers. Each lake, if it holds any drop of precious fluid, is named and put on the forest map. Titles such as Lamb's Lake, Crane Lake, Three Lakes, and others don't necessarily guarantee enough to water a horse, but can claim a unique setting, often with old corral, drooping fences, and perhaps a tumble-down cabin to give it the romantic touch. At some, like historic Jacob Lake, the scent of the woods gathers in the clearing, heated to burning incense and light at deserted altars of another day. It is easy to believe that ghosts of Indians or early pioneers can be heard fluttering through the dark mantled trees that mass in the background. When the gracious stands of trees of many species and varieties have been mentioned, as sinks marveled at in the meadows touched upon, there is still much more to be said of the great green world of the Kaibab. Anyone who knows the forest has his favorite haunts, deserving, he feels, a special dimension, yet far too many to dwell upon at length. Jolly Sink can hardly be ignored, where bawling cattle gather around several small pools in a natural corral appropriate for a movie set in some cattle rustling tale of Zane Grey's. Even more to my liking is the smaller paradise called Billy Sink, entered through a limestone gateway and walled in by naked cliffs and slopes of aspen. At the proper time, there are flowers on the grass floor, lupines, and Indian paintbrush, but never any standing water. Favorite with anyone who has made the 17-mile pilgrimage from the main park road to Port Sublime is Cannabonus Canyon. All the magic of the forest is here. Open stretches of musical pines, closed ranks of fir and spruce, and miles of aspen interspersed with clearings shaped to the rolling ground and dedicated to deer. The road finally catches up with Cannabonus Creek, chorting softly to itself as it sparkles a little way above ground, and then happily loses itself in a field full of dandelion and columbine. Another mile up and out, onto the very brink of the North Rim, breaks into vastly different terrain. The forest gives way to dense chaparral of scrub oak and locust, and the pinyon pine takes over at the crest, towering over cliff rose, sage, and a ground covering of prickly pear and tiny hedgehog cactus. Here the sun is blinding and hot, the desert rock garden prickly but brilliant in flower, and the 150-mile panorama east, west, and south, truly one of the sublime views on the continent, is one more facet of the amazing Kaibab. Another view of vast proportions opens at the end of a forest drive toward the east. Its destination, North Canyon, is a study in tree conquest over even rugged, deep-cut walls. When the visitor can tear his eyes from its velvet gorge, punctuated by rock outcroppings, a desert world stretches to infinity. Thousands of feet below, House Rock Valley is an open expanse, cut by the slender, shadowy serpentine of the marble gorge of the Colorado River. North Canyon, South Canyon, and lesser fingers from the Kaibab probe with diminishing strength its sun-swept surface, and the tiny brown dots that seem to dance before the vision are cattle or some of the 200 head of bison that graze on its grass. Still on beyond, the Echo Cliffs stand in a jagged line, and 150 miles from the outlook is the black hump of Navajo Mountain, far out on the skyline. Toward the north rises the escarpment of the Marillion Cliffs, and depending upon the clearness of the day, you can see above them one, two, or three, or even more ascending steps of mighty plateaus that are crowned ultimately by the pink cliffs of Bryce Canyon. From these almost two splendid exposés of naked rock and vulnerable earth, the shelter of the trees is welcome, comforting both to be lived with. There is security if fewer grand vistas down lovely Castle Canyon, for example. The woods whisper companionably around you, and pleasing glimpses of stone battlements are framed in green along the way as the road picks its meandering and leisurely course towards Big Springs. There, a charmingly homey sight is enlivened by water pouring straight out of a hill wall and dropping to make its way through a meadow and provide ample for several small snug houses attendant upon a nearby lookout tower. There are gratifyingly few people in the Kaibab. Here and there are the summer quarters for fire guard or other servants of the forest and park's needs, all official and quite restrained. The little settlement at Jacob Lake, where US 89A makes a junction with the park approach road and then hurries off the mountain again, retires modestly under the great ponderosas, and with Kaibab Lodge at VT Park offers the only tourist lodgings outside of the park. The flood of summer visitors bound for the North Rim keep foolishly, I think, to the main paved road, and fall brings its influx of hunters. The latter take over those parts of the forest where game is most likely to be found, mitigating the fine Kaibab bucks, especially prized as trophies, and some merely getting lost. In that season, the mountain's only attraction to the tourist is the flamboyant color of the aspens, riotous enough along the safe paved road. But spring and summer find the cool depths, the glorious spread of wild woodland, quiet and going about its own nicely timed business. It is still the forest primeval, a place to find oneself away from the distractions of modern life. Even the Paiute is gone, and the only sounds are the wind, the birds, the snap of a branch under the foot of some wild thing. Seasons pass lightly over this ancient forest of the Kaibab, carved in Olympic grandeur from the glowering desert and smiled upon surely by the gods who planted it for anyone, whether man or the four-footed creatures who revel in its solitude. And this concludes The Green Roof of the Kaibab. Kathy Montgomery writes about Teufel. Classic games and toys, magic tricks, juggle balls, scooters, this Wonka-like wonderland has just about anything you can imagine, including wooden toys from France, ocarinas from Peru, and djembe drums from Africa. Prescott's Cortez Street is a whirlwind of sound and color as a Teufel toy shop disgorges a gaggle of school kids swirling around co-owner Brad James and yo-yo instructor Caleb Funeri onto the sidewalk. Tall and lean, Funeri listens with interest to each child in turn, then leans down to one boy to say, "You haven't been here since the first session, so we've got some catching up to do." "I'm not very good," the boy says. "I can only do up, down, up, down." So, after it goes up, down, up, down, then we do a sleeper, Ferner says, letting his yo-yo spin on the end of its string. "And that's when you can do walk the dog and tricks like that. Can I try?" "Yeah, yeah, yeah," Funeri says, smiling brightly. With a jovial round face, James looks like an old-fashioned toy maker in his trademark cap and apron. A trained illustrator, he developed websites for 20 years before opening Teufel. Sitting in front of a computer all day, he noticed his children spent a lot of time on devices too. It seemed to him that they were experiencing a different childhood than he had and didn't engage in as much creative play. "I wanted to build something to have alternatives to technology," he recalls, "and toys were it. A visit to a toy store with his sons years ago helped plant the seed that became Teufel." Mr. B's Toys occupied a tiny room on Main Street in Jerome, but it made a big impression. We walked in the door, and owner Guy Barbera immediately interacted with us, James recalls. He launched an air cannon at us. He tried to get me to write my signature with a shock pen. It was an experience we remembered and talked about for years. Many years and many visits to toy stores around the country passed before James opened Toyful in 2023. He'd been trying to figure out how to combine toy and joyful for the name when he happened upon the dictionary definition for Toyful, meaning full of trifling play. It was perfect, and it's not an accident that the exaggerated curve in the logo's top-headed T can be read as a backward J, and James smiles when people mistakenly refer to the store as Joyful. He filled the store to the rafters with classic games and toys, magic tricks, juggle balls, and scooters, as well as toys from around the world, wooden toys from France, ocarinas from Peru, and djembe drums from Africa, to name a few. But he also stocked the creations of local makers, including crocheted stuffed animals and 3D printed puzzles. James's wife, Alice Ross, was working as a kindergarten aide when Toyful opened, but she soon quit her job to join James at the store full-time. His expertise is in tricks, games, and skill toys. He once belonged to a local juggling club, while her specialties include younger kids' toys and dress-up play. She also creates the seasonal window displays. And it was Ross's idea to build, at the center of the store, a massive tree she decorates with twinkling fairy houses at Christmas time. Walking through a space they were considering, James noticed a giant column in the middle of the room. I said, "There's our tree," he recalls. They use stacks of books and 100 cans of spray foam for the trunk, while a pair of former Hollywood set designers offered tips for building the branches. The couple outfitted the rest of the store with repurposed shelving and painted thrift store finds to complement the homey, whimsical feel. Although Toyful has its own entrance on Cortez, is part of the Art Hive, an artist collective that took over a sprawling 15,000 square foot space that formerly housed an antiques mall. The store stays open late every fourth Friday of the month for Prescott's Art Walk. The store's tree is, after all, a giant art project, and James enjoys being part of a community devoted to creativity. It's a nice fit because toys can inspire just that, he says. Accompanying her boys to Yo-Yo Club, longtime customer Laurel Dickinson says Toyful embodies the sweetness and magic of childhood. They have all the things out there for you to try, and they're fantastic about letting the kids engage, she says. It becomes a destination. Dickinson says her kids especially love the birthday book, a massive leather-bound volume where kids can write their birthdays. For 2 weeks around their special day, they get 20% off their purchases. It's exactly the kind of reaction James hoped Toyful might inspire. "I don't think objects can bring joy," he says, "but I do believe toys inspire creativity and they inspire interaction, and that can bring joy to people's lives." Toyful is located at 205 North Cortez Street in Prescott. Phone number 928-351-7453. Website toyful.shop. And this concludes Toyful. Noah Austin is the author of Tassie Ranch and Pacoon Springs. On average, about 14,000 people a day visit Grand Canyon National Park. That's a lot. Much more than Grand Canyon Perchant National Monument, which sees about 200 visitors a day. If you're looking for solitude along with history, ecology, and vast panoramas, the monument is a place to be. Since 2000, Grand Canyon Perchant National Monument has protected a vast, diverse landscape on the canyon's north rim, and almost no one has seen it. That's to be expected, given that parts of the 1-million-acre monument are inaccessible in the winter and others are oppressively hot in the summer. Throw in Perchant being a long drive from almost everywhere and lacking a single paved road, and you can understand why only 200 people per day on average pay the monument a visit. But there's plenty to discover at Perchant, including in its western section, where two sites celebrate the monument's human history and unique ecology. According to Perchant Superintendent Ben Roberts, both are valuable for their intersection of cultural heritage and environmental considerations. They're nice to look at, too. There aren't many places in northwestern Arizona where you can find a hillside of Joshua trees a stone's throw from a stand of tall cottonwoods. That juxtaposition is part of the appeal at Coon Springs, where perennial water has created a riparian oasis in the middle of the high desert. It's also a place, Robert says, where visitors can understand and appreciate the importance of restoring natural habitats for natural species. The place was somewhat unnatural for a while. Starting in the 1960s, Chuck Simmons owned the Pocoon area and kept pigs and burros there. He also tried to cash in on a 1980s craze by raising some 500 ostriches, but demand for ostrich meat soon cratered, and he was forced to give away most of the birds. The most famous resident, though, was Clem, an 8-foot alligator imported from Georgia as a gift from Simmons' friends. According to the National Park Service, the gator kept to himself most days, barring a few exceptions when he was lured out with 7 whole chickens or children swimming in his pond. Clem proved elusive enough that after the monument's creation, it took multiple attempts for a team from the Phoenix area to capture and remove him in 2003. Since then, the monument, jointly managed by the Park Service and the Bureau of Land Management, has aimed to return the springs to their natural state. Workers have removed a dwelling, non-native plants, and large stock ponds, allowing native vegetation to thrive and water to flow freely. The team has also introduced the relic leopard frog, found only in this corner of the Southwest and once thought to be extinct. The result is a verdant landscape that cools the surrounding air and provides habitat for migratory birds and bighorn sheep. It's a draw for visitors, too, who can explore Pocoon Springs via an easy loop trail from the parking area. These days, the risk of an alligator attack is as low as it gets. While the human element has largely been removed from Pocoon Springs, Tassie Ranch, several miles down the road, preserves one of Arizona's most remote homesteads, a dwelling built by Ed Yates in the 1930s near several more of the area's springs. A close look at the house illustrates how hard it was to find building materials in such an isolated location. Rather than the log construction typical of the time and region, Yates used rocks that had been quarried from the area and likely used in an earlier building. Described by the Park Service as a rough-and-tumble cattleman, Yates went on to improve the springs, plant shade trees and crops, and construct corrals and an irrigation system. Crops at Tassie Ranch included tomatoes, corn, watermelon, and chard. Yates and members of his family lived there for decades before selling the ranch to the Whitmore family, who owned it until the Park Service took full control after the monument's creation. Robert says the site is a remarkable example of ranching history in this arid region, adding that the adaptations employed there illustrate the challenges of ranching in a remote desert environment. Attractions at Tassie Ranch include the springs, home to the speckled dace, the only native fish species at Parashant, along with the barn and corrals. The centerpiece, though, is the stone ranch house, which is closed to visitors due to hantavirus risks and concerns about structural integrity. Robert says that won't change anytime soon, but plans are in place to maintain the house and the surrounding landscape where visitors are welcome to explore. For a panoramic view of the site, continue past it and up the hill to the southwest, where a vault toilet sits near an old airstrip. From there, you can see Tassie Ranch's isolation amid rolling desert hills, and it's a view you're likely to have all to yourself. It's Parashant, after all. That concludes today's readings from Arizona Highways. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.